Welcome to Policy Speaking, a podcast that checks in every week with the people at the center of the debates about where Canadian policy should be headed, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. We speak with the thinkers, doers, and deciders about how good policy can make for a better Canada. We'll be putting out a new episode every Thursday, so please join us weekly if you're up for a deep dive into the policy choices in front of us and the trade-offs involved. Here's the host of Policy Speaking, Edward Greenspan, President and CEO of the Public Policy Forum and former Editor-in-Chief of the Globe and Mail.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Edward Greenspan. Today, we're joined by Georgina Black on Policy Speaking, Managing Partner for Government, Public Services and Healthcare at Deloitte. We'll be talking about long-term care, which has been obviously a huge issue throughout the pandemic, and how Canada might reimagine its systems to be centered around how seniors actually want to age. So not just fix it, but reimagine it. And as I think we'll hear, reimagine it being less institutional and more at home. But first, I'm joined by Katie Davey, Policy Speaking's executive producer, and Sean Speer, who is the recently anointed PPF Scotiabank Fellow in Strategic Competitiveness. So Katie, welcome back to, I always say welcome back to the show, and then I sort of think it's your show. So good to be with you again here. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ed. I'd actually just love to start by hearing more from Sean about the new fellowship and kind of what Sean, you hope to accomplish in this role and really how and why it came to be.
Well, thanks, Katie, and thanks for having me on Policy Speaking again, particularly to talk about this new exciting partnership between the Public Policy Forum and Scotiabank, focused on this question of economic competitiveness in general, and an industrial strategy for Canada in particular. The focus in recent weeks and months, of course, has been on the pandemic and the public health and economic fallout stemming from the pandemic. But the truth is, Canada's economy has been sort of stuck in slow growth, what's sometimes referred to as secular stagnation, for the better part of 20 years. And we hope through this fellowship, through this partnership between the Public Policy Forum and Scotiabank, to begin to develop a comprehensive policy agenda that will not just pull us out of the depths of the pandemic-induced recession, but push back against what we've come to describe as the 2% trap, referring to average 2% growth over the past two decades or so, and aspire to higher rates of growth and productivity in the name of more jobs, more investment, and ultimately broad-based opportunity for Canadians. And so, at the Public Policy Forum's website, people will be able to find the first paper that we've produced as part of this fellowship called Beyond 2%. And in the coming weeks and months, a series of policy papers, events, and other ways to try to promote and disseminate different policy ideas that we think can ultimately support economic growth in this country and create the conditions that for inclusion, for opportunity, and for ultimately higher standards of living for Canadians, because of course fundamentally that's what it's all about. And so I'm just honored to be the first PPF Scotiabank Fellow, and grateful both to the PPF and Scotiabank to give me this platform and opportunity to pursue this important, timely work.
Well, Sean, we're delighted to have you aboard because it is important work and it's been very central to PPF's mission for a number of years, what we talk about as the social and economic determinants of growth and how we get greater growth and greater competitiveness, for the betterment of Canadians, obviously. You mentioned, something that we've talked about a fair bit, the 2% growth trap, and this idea of beyond 2% has been, something we had a conference on in 2016, and we're still not beyond 2%. So how did the budget look to you in terms of getting back to 2% and getting beyond 2%?
Well, let's just start by recognizing that the government was in a terribly difficult position between managing the immediacy, the ongoing immediacy of the pandemic on one hand, and then looking towards a post-pandemic recovery on the other hand. I think Jennifer Robson, who's a regular author with the Public Policy Forum, described the budget as, in effect, two different budgets. And I think that in many ways is the right way to think about it. But on the question of 2%, let me just read a short quote from the budget, and I think really reflects why we're doing this work and why this work is so important. The budget observes, quote, real GDP is expected to moderate to about 2% on average per year as we come out of the worst of the pandemic, reflecting a return to trend long run growth rates. And I guess in a nutshell, the purpose of this fellowship and the work that the PPF, as you said, has been doing for some time, and we intend to kind of supercharge in the coming weeks and months, is to make the case that that long run growth rate isn't enough, and that we shouldn't be complacent, we shouldn't accept it, that we do have agency, that there is indeed a role for public policy to push up against that 2% trap that we seem stuck in and aspire to more growth, more productivity, and ultimately more opportunity for Canadians. And you know, that's I think yesterday's budget in some ways made a down payment on the types of things that we're going to need to break out of the 2% trap. And we hope to develop and popularize other policy reforms that will ultimately aid governments at the federal level and provincial level in that all important mission.
I think it's interesting, Sean, that the budget, you know, makes that specific reference, because it also made the specific reference that, its childcare investment would have kind of a contribution of 1.2% to GDP. Economists like Jim Stanford argue that it would actually be much more. So, you know, when I'm kind of looking at that, I wonder, you know, how is it possible that all other measures perhaps would only contribute about 0.8%? And, you know, I'm oversimplifying it, but I'd be interested to know your thoughts on that.
Well, it's maybe worth stepping back for a second and recognizing that Canadian real GDP growth has been falling decade over decade since the 1960s. And, you know, part of that is a reflection of a series of what are sometimes referred to as secular headwinds. Take, for instance, aging demographics or declining business investment or low levels of innovation. So there are some big kind of structural reasons why the economy has been slowing over time. And then the question is, what factors are outside our control, at least in the short term, and what factors are indeed within our control? What are the purview of public policy? And the budget makes the case, I think, and as you say, others have similarly made the case, that one way to contribute on the margins to higher rates of economic growth is to expand access to childcare. And so, you know, it'll be interesting in the coming weeks and months to see the government roll out this plan and ultimately see the impact on growth. But I would just say, Katie, it reflects at a kind of conceptual level, one of the key insights, I think, of the Public Policy Forum's work on the economic and social determinants of growth, and something that will no doubt be reflected in the work that I'm doing in my role as PPF Scotiabank Fellow, that the public policy levers associated with growth are evolving. You know, that traditionally the view was the principal levers associated with growth were tax policy, regulation, monetary policy, and so on. And I think there's growing evidence, particularly given the circumstances that are a constraint on growth, that we're going to need to leverage other policy tools, including greater access to childcare, if we're indeed going to break out of this 2% trap. And I think one thing we want to achieve as part of this fellowship is to produce a kind of richer, more textured understanding of the different policy levers that will ultimately be necessary to boost and support higher rates of growth over the long run.
But, you know, you use the word agency, and that we have agency, and, you know, we have policy choices that we can make. And certainly, you know, we've seen other countries, we've seen our own country at different times in its history make better choices and worse choices. Do you build infrastructure? Do you build the infrastructure for the future? Is childcare now a form of infrastructure, as many people are saying? Do you have policies that create, and you've written a lot about this, Sean, and we've discussed this around a lot, you know, greater ownership of intellectual property, or which is a wealth creator now in a way that it never has been before. And, you know, do we have those policies in place? Do we have policies to attract investment? Do we have policies that get us through the energy transition properly? Do we have policies that, you know, one of the Canada's, you know, great policy advantages has been immigration. So, you know, we do have an ability to bring new people into our country and our labor market and their ideas and their efforts. So clearly, that agency allows you to have some kind of swing in growth. And let's say for a moment that swing was 0.5%. Good policy or bad policy can get you 0.5% more growth. Well, over, you know, 10 or 20 years, that is a lot of income for people. That is a lot of per capita income in that 0.5%, isn't it?
Yeah, George Will, the Pulitzer Prize winning columnist, says the difference between 2% growth and 3% growth is at 1%, it's 50%. And with the benefit of compounding growth, it as you say, can have a meaningful impact on individuals and households and businesses. If I can just pick up something implicit in your question, let me quote Carolyn Wilkins, our former deputy governor of the Bank of Canada, who said in a 2020 speech, there are, quote, a galaxy of ways to boost growth. In other words, yes, we need to recognize that we're fighting against some pretty powerful secular headwinds like demographics and so on, but we can't become fatalistic. As former Deputy Governor Wilkins observes, we do have means at our disposal to support higher rates of growth, but that's going to require something you kind of both have implicitly recognized. One, that we're going to have to think holistically across different policy levers. And secondly, we're going to have to think in a kind of modern way about the different tools to support growth. And that's partly because of different contexts, you know, maybe different values. But a big part of it, Ed and Katie, is that the world is changing. The last time we had a serious kind of systematic review of the need to orient ourselves to growth and productivity, we were living in mostly a unipolar world. We were living in a goods producing economy, not an intangibles economy. We were in a kind of ideational framework that was shaped by, you know, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, and politically by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. There's a whole host of big contextual kind of contingent factors that have changed. And, you know, there's a need for us to kind of similarly change the way we think about growth, change the way we think about public policy, change the way we think about an industrial strategy for Canada, which is really at the center of this new partnership between the Public Policy Forum and Scotiabank. So I guess just in sum, I'm really excited. I hope you can kind of hear that in my voice, because I think we're at kind of a paradigmatic moment where there's a window for new thinking about economic policy, new thinking about ways to support growth and productivity. And I hope that the Public Policy Forum, through this fellowship, is at the kind of center of that conversation and, you know, starting to build support around a modern growth agenda that can ultimately break us out of the 2% trap that that the budget itself recognizes that we're, for better or for worse, presently stuck in.
Okay, well, look, as we're getting ready to wrap up, and I don't want to quite wrap up yet, but let's each take one thing in the budget, one aspect that we think is very important, whether it's, you know, just been introduced or it's more advanced, that will help us on the road to greater growth in future. And as I say, it could be a little bit of a known or a hinted at. So I'm going to start with you, Katie. And you are the youngest among us, although Shauna is still fairly young by my standards, too.
I can't get the vaccine yet.
So Katie, you've got a long stake in long-term growth. So what out of the budget really jumped out at you in that way?
Yeah, well, thanks for the question, Ed. I guess as I'm kind of thinking of this conversation right now, you know, I'm thinking back to, to Sean's point, this holistic approach and how important that, other indicators will be, including just the GDP, right? GDP growth means nothing if all Canadians are not sharing in that. And, you know, we have started to see trends. One of the economists I follow quite closely is Branko Milanovic, who talks about income inequality. And he's written extensively about mature economies, obviously Canada being one of, and how growth is really continuing to not be shared among the middle and lower kind of deciles. So as I look at the budget, I looked at things and was interested in things like, you know, the federal government signaling that they are going to have a $15 federal minimum wage, things like an expansion of the Canada's worker benefit for low-income folks, a reimagining, actually that's maybe a strong word, not a reimagining, but some new focus on EI, increasing the old age security. All of these pieces that, again, really do target those in our society that are currently in kind of the lowest income bracket, and really making sure that we're lifting those folks up. Because, again, you know, growth for me, growth doesn't matter if it's not shared among everybody. So I'd be interested to see how those things roll out. And again, as always, the devil is in the details. But I was quite pleased to see kind of a broad look at those programs.
So I would share with you that growth only works well if it's inclusive and if it includes everybody. But I guess I'm old school enough to think that first you need the growth and then you need the distribution, because I don't want to be distributing a smaller and smaller pie. That's not going to help anybody in the lowest quintile of income or in any other quintile of income. So, you know, I was taken by the, you know, some of the long-term questions that were there, not there. It's hard to be too attentive to long-term when you've got still a conflagration going on about you with the pandemic, but there was the beginning of some thinking, and we've done a lot of work at the Energy Future Forum in Public Policy Forum, you know, trying to figure out what kind of energy system we'll have that will benefit Canadians in terms of their securities of supply and their affordability and the economic productivity and stimulus it can provide to the system. And there was, you know, there was a fair bit on that, some of it just setting the stage, particularly around, you know, what for some people is a controversial question about carbon capture and, you know, taking carbon out of the system. I think the budget talks about it as one of the few policies that has the potential to get you negative carbon by taking carbon out, that's as well in the, you know, not just in production, but direct air capture. Of which there's a leading Canadian company, Carbon Engineering. So there is going to be an investment tax credit to that effect, the budget tells us. There's a 90-day consultation before we'll see that. And so, you know, there's more work to be done there, and it'll be interesting to be watching that and feeding into that over the next little while. Sean, you want to pick one?
Yeah, I'll be as brief as I can. I would just say that I agree with what both have said, that higher rates of growth are a necessary but insufficient condition for, you know, the type of broad-based opportunity inclusion, you know, what's sometimes described as human flourishing. So I agree that we need to think about these things sort of comprehensively. But I also agree at the end of the day, you know, we need to get this economy growing faster, and you know, it won't solve every problem, but it will solve a lot. And in that vein, I agree, Ed, that the most interesting and forward-looking parts of the budget were primarily focused on operationalizing the commitment to net zero emissions. So whether it's the net zero accelerator, which looks like it will be designed with the goal of kind of seeding different forms of technology and getting them to scale, and, you know, all their commercialization and ultimately scale is really interesting. I thought, you know, a one that may have gone below the radar was a preferential corporate tax rate for businesses that manufacture zero emissions technologies. This almost looks like a kind of small C conservative approach to the kind of climate change question, which I thought was interesting. So, I agree very much that where the government seems to have kind of leaned in most to a kind of dynamism agenda, it's primarily in the area of net zero and clean technology. And, you know, I think that's really promising. And you know, as you say, I look forward to learning more about how those different programs are going to be rolled out in the coming weeks and months.
The good news is that our podcast next week will be looking squarely at climate, energy, policy, et cetera, in the lens of the budget. So if folks are also interested in what Ed and Sean are, then I think stay tuned for next week as well.
And I think By next week, we'll have a little bit more sense of the directions in which this is headed and a little bit more understanding of what the government's doing. And we'll have also seen U.S. President Biden's climate summit, which is, you know, very important because these issues now have become very North American and in terms of levels of cooperation, levels of competitiveness as well. So a lot to look forward to. But before we get there, we are going to be having a discussion with Georgina Black, the managing partner for government public services and healthcare at Deloitte, about one of the sorest points, I think, that the pandemic has shown up, one of the weakest parts of our system, which is long-term care. To some extent, some of the issues are similar to childcare. You know, it's an area we need to pay attention to. It doesn't actually produce the same economic effects in terms of freeing up people to have the choice to be in the labor market if they choose. But it is an area where we have labor shortages, where we don't have probably appropriate training, appropriate compensation to attract people in, and we need to, reorganize. And we are going to have a national debate about long-term care. It's already breaking out, as we are having one about childcare. Money's now on the table from the federal government, but how exactly it'll be organized will be interesting. So next up, Georgina Black, and I want to thank you, Sean. Thank you, Katie, for joining me in conversation today.
Thanks, Ed.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Katie.
It's my pleasure to introduce Georgina Black, Canadian Managing Partner for Government, Public Services, and Healthcare at Deloitte. Georgina is a thought leader and speaker on the future of government and the future of healthcare. She recently co-authored Deloitte's Catalyst 2030 report on the future of Canada and a recently released white paper on how to make Canada the best place in the world to grow old. And Georgina is a good friend of the Public Policy Forum. So welcome, Georgina.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be here. Hello, everyone.
Okay, so Georgina, today's session is born out of kind of catch-up conversation we had several weeks ago. And I've got to say, you were feeling, quite concerned that the dialogue we have entered into about long-term care wasn't sufficiently imaginative or ambitious, and that we're, perhaps asking the wrong questions, and therefore might draw the wrong conclusions. So that's what we want to talk about. But let's just start very briefly with the pandemic as a teaching moment, and then we'll move towards lasting solutions. So, we've had huge numbers of deaths in long-term care, high proportion, a great tragedy. To what extent was this an avoidable tragedy?
Well, Ed, I'm afraid there's going to be likely a number of commissions that are going to be more precise in answering that question. The way that I would think about this problem existed well before the pandemic. The issue with respect to elders, seniors, long-term care has been studied for decades. There are numerous reports that have highlighted the structural, the systemic issues related to long-term care. In addition, we also have learnings from the SARS experience. And I think there are questions being raised about, did we really bring forward those lessons to respond to this current pandemic? So what are the challenges that existed beforehand, and could they have been addressed in the crisis of a pandemic? They're pretty systemic and structural. There are significant silos across long-term care, seniors care. Variety of ministries touch this file. There's, as we'll get to eventually, a complex ecosystem of public, private providers, not-for-profit providers. Funding is both government and private pay. Care for seniors is sort of lost in this space of, is it a housing solution we're providing? Is it a social care solution? Is it a medical care solution? And of course, all of those are funded differently. And there isn't even the discussion around long-term care. Like, what are we talking about here? Is it the actual institution? Is it home care? Is it housing? There were issues with labor and staffing shortages well before this pandemic. I read recently that for those positions, there's 40% vacancies across Canada. The World Health Organization published a few years ago that they expect there will be 18 million shortage of health human resources workers worldwide. we haven't kept pace with immigration to bring people in to support this industry. And regulation, you know, in a way, it's one of the most regulated industries, but is it really regulating the right things?
Yeah.
And so it's a complex mix of structural systemic issues that existed before and a number of reports. And how do you fix some of those things in flight? Arguably, I think history will say there were things that we should have done to avoid the first wave and the second wave of this tragedy.
So let's break off one piece of what you said there, because it's becoming hotly debated in political circles, and that is the talk of public versus private. And as you know, the NDP has called for the elimination of private care, brought a motion before Parliament, is making this a major part of their pre-election dialogue. So is private versus public the right frame for thinking about the future?
Well, Ed, you didn't take long to get right into it, did you? Let me just step back for a moment. Because of the tragedy that has happened in long-term care homes, my concern is that we're focusing on that set of institutions where seniors, elders end up, and we're trying to fix that. And this is where I am concerned that we're actually trying to fix the wrong problem. And that's important in the context of the public-private debate, because as we want to fix the long-term care institutions, we're having this discussion around public sector, private sector providers. So I'm not going to avoid the question, but I'm going to lift up again and say, you know, moving to sort of what does great look like? Great looks like we have a system that actually meets the needs of the consumers. And there is survey after survey that has been released that shows 90% of Canadians want to age in place.
And by that, we mean at home.
At home or in the community. And we'll come on to what those kinds of options are. Yet we have a system that almost drives, orients people to move into a long-term care institution, which is, by the way, the most expensive place to receive care. So I think we need to make sure we lift up and make sure we're solving the right problem, which is how do we create a great ecosystem of care for seniors throughout their journey? Coming back to your question around public and private, I understand the debate and I understand the passion around the debate. I do think we need to round out this conversation to consider, is there a different way for governments to contract with commission the provision of long-term care to get a different outcome? And this is where, depending on which province you're in, some provinces see this as a housing solution for seniors, some see it as a social care solution for seniors, some as a medical, and some is a bit of all three. And so what they're purchasing or commissioning from public or private providers arguably isn't well defined in terms of contracting for health and social care outcomes for the residents in those institutions. So that's the first point. I think we need to look at what was government actually contracting through those long-term care organizations, and is there a better, different way to do that? The second is, I think we have to make sure that we create the conditions for innovation in seniors care, because it's one of the last sectors in this country to innovate. There are pockets of great innovation, but it's not at scale. We need to think differently about that.
Could you give us an example, just for a second, of a great innovation, what you mean when you're talking about innovating?
Right, sure. So thinking about use of technology for seniors. Like, so when you saw all these seniors in long-term care, very sad situations where people, families couldn't see. I couldn't see my mom for 13 weeks. Wouldn't it be wonderful if it had already been in place that she had an iPad and it was very easy for her to push just a few buttons to connect with me or other members of the family to address the social isolation that is a significant factor for seniors. There are all sorts of innovations that will come on to Open Lab through UHN is doing really cool stuff in terms of supporting naturally occurring retirement communities referred to as NORCs and allowing people to sort of age in place. So some of the features that you would find in a long-term care setting, but in the community where the senior has lived for many years and creating the conditions where there is ongoing social connectivity, which is important, shared kitchen, and you actually take the support, medical, social care staff into that actual community. So I mean, there's a whole lot more to be said around innovation, but the question is, if this all becomes public sector, do we risk losing the opportunity for innovation from the private sector or perhaps both the public and private sector? And the last point that I'll say on this is, while I'm going to be talking a lot about the importance of home and community care, I do acknowledge, and the evidence shows that there is a need for long-term care institutions, and there's a requirement for massive upgrading, because a lot of the issue that happened in long-term care was because we had four residents sort of in a ward room. And so it's very difficult in terms of infection prevention and control in those kinds of environments. So there's billions of dollars that's required to actually upgrade facilities and build new facilities to keep up with demand. So those are three considerations with respect to the role of the private sector.
Well, I think that takes us very naturally to perhaps another framing, which isn't necessarily a rival framing, but a different framing, which is, you know, long-term care versus home care. I mean, you've said how some 90% of people want to stay in place. So you've recently co-authored a report which is called Making Canada the Best Place in the World to Age by 2030, a senior-centric strategy. And in it, one of the things you said that caught my eye is this is a critical moment for Canada's aged care ecosystem. What we do next will speak to the character of our nation, whether we live by our core values or pay them only lip service. So paint us a picture of what a senior-centered policy looks like that speaks to our character.
So just on a personal note, I really became interested in seniors care probably 8 or 9 years ago. I brought over a wonderful person named Professor Paul Corrigan from the UK to meet with some governments across Canada about how to involve patients and their families in diagnosing and developing care plans for those with chronic conditions. And the research of the UK shows that you can actually take 10 to 15% out of the healthcare system by what they describe as activating patients and caregivers in their community. And so anyway, so Professor Corrigan is a senior himself, so very kind of attuned to the cues in various countries that he travels to. And as he was, you know, we'd seen about three provinces, and as he was leaving, he said, "I wouldn't want to be a senior in Canada." It feels the narrative, he said, is that seniors are an incredible burden on the healthcare system. We refer to them as bed blockers, ALC patients, alternative level of care patients. All the concerns around the budgets are related to the burden that seniors are going to put on the financial systems. So that really struck with me. And then thinking about other cultures who really honor and revere their seniors and how you take care of your seniors tells a lot about society. So I think this is our moment as a country to change the narrative, to embrace our seniors, to honor and respect them, and to use words like dignity, choice, challenge ourselves with ageism. So that's the first piece. And so in terms of how to get there from here, this is also the time to set an ambition. So not a budget, right? I heard someone tell me the other day that government budget is code for strategy in government. So I'm not going to use those words. I'm going to talk about an ambition, a vision. And this gets to the paper, Ed. So is it possible for Canada to become the best place in the world to age by 2030? Can we start to think about age-friendly communities, age-friendly policies. We know that 90% of people want to age in place at home or in the community. This is the only sector I can think of where there's such a mismatch between what a consumer wants and what's actually available to them in the marketplace.
Well, perhaps that speaks to the ageism, because those consumers don't have much power and there's, you know, a huge knowledge gap probably there. But you refer in the paper as an example to Denmark.
Right.
One of several countries that that you talk about what they're doing. And, you know, you clearly say there's no perfect country. Everybody's struggling with this. Nonetheless, in Denmark, you know, two things really struck me. One, they haven't built a single retirement home in 20 years. Now, they have an aging population like everywhere else, but they haven't had to build a single retirement. You know, that's an extraordinary factoid, if you will. And that they're spending on home care versus long care is long-term care is about two-thirds home care, one-third long-term care, the inverse of ours.
Exactly.
So what lessons are you taking from Denmark that we could be applying here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to just qualify my answer here is, as I said at the beginning of this, Ed, there have been so many studies and reports written on what the answer should be. The Romanov report, the Gail Donner Commission report, there's loads of guidance here that tells us that the current state is unacceptable and that the answer is to embrace a senior-centered model of care, which then goes back to they want to age in place. So then to design an ecosystem that provides the services that are required for those seniors in place. So this is really about flipping this on its head from an orientation towards institutionalization of seniors to allowing seniors, enabling seniors to age in place through home supports and community support. So I talked about Norks as an example. There's villages. Toronto Community Housing has done some great things allowing people who are already in apartments to age in place, bringing supports to them. Those are important innovations. And then of course the home care sector, which is also, there's a role there at the moment for private and public providers. We need to shift funding or allocate funding there to address this issue. And why wouldn't we consider some goals like Denmark? Could we flip that allocation of spend? Because, you know, people often ask, well, why is Deloitte actually interested in this problem, right? It seems like a social care problem. Well, we actually are very much interested in societal issues that relate to people. So that's the first thing. But the second thing, this is very much an economic discussion as well. And this is one reason I really want to try to give voice to it, is to knit together all of these different pieces, because we work across the public and private sector. We understand the economic opportunity that is here. So just, you know, again, loads of reports on this. It is far more expensive to provide care to someone in long-term care than it is at home. Dr. Sinha has just released a report through National Institute for Aging, estimates that long-term care will cost $85,000 per resident. That care provided at home, it's hard to land, clinicians on the line will tell you it's hard to say it's exactly $35,000 for one person, it might be 13, for another it might be closer to 70, but overall, it's going to be a whole lot less expensive to provide care at home. And then there's other economic benefits by keeping a senior in their community in terms of their ability to engage, to stay healthier longer, contribute to the economy, those sorts of things.
You know, keep themselves involved. You know, I have, my mom is in a independent living seniors home, which is a mix. Some people are independent and there's floors where people have more advanced dementia and Alzheimer's and they're not. And it's a privately owned institution, very middle class pricing, not low income and not high end either. They've done very well in terms of COVID. There's been almost, there's no death that I know of. There's, you know, only been about 10 to 20 cases, as far as I know. But I could see what isolation does. because she's been more isolated because of COVID. And that's been, you know, problematic in terms of her progress or regress, you know, certainly. And I guess that's what to me, a bad seniors home looks like. I understand why it's happened in this case, but.
Well, you bring up a good point, because the risk with shifting everything to home care is that you reinforce social isolation. It's an unintended consequence, right? And we saw this play out in the UK, and the UK appointed, and only people in England could call it this, a minister of loneliness to address the issue, right?
Paul McCartney writes the ministries in England. So,
so this is a significant issue. And again, this is where there are interesting innovations. You can, you know, activate and train up a volunteer workforce in a community nationally to support seniors in their home, to do visits. Again, you can use technology. I just wanted to point out that isolation.
I think it's an important point also, because another model you look at, and perhaps you tell us if they're getting closer to a happy medium here, is Ireland and age-based communities. Tell us just for a moment what that is.
Yeah, so this is really about the country and municipalities adopting age-friendly policies. And so everything from, do you clear the roads and sidewalks first in the young family neighborhoods, and or do you also pay attention to where seniors live? So what are the, you know, strategies that you can use to enable seniors to stay safe and to age in place? And, you know, Canada has some interesting pieces. I don't mean to come across as sounding critical. I want to come across as sounding aspirational. You know, the federal government's introduced New Horizons. And so that's an opportunity for community organizations to apply for grants, $25,000, to support age-friendly supports and interventions in place. I think the difference between Ireland and Canada is it's part of the kind of national kind of, I keep using that word, narrative. And so is this our opportunity to think of Canada as becoming famous for being an age-friendly country, a great place for seniors, but great place for all of us to grow old? And I just want to add something here, because I'm concerned that people aren't talking about this. You know, when a lot of our programs were developed for social care, for pensions and so forth, the life expectancy was sort of in its 60s, it's now in its 80s. There is really strong research now coming out from Dr. David Sinclair at Harvard. There's a whole bunch of physicians who are studying lifespans and are very focused on longevity, and believe that in the next 10 years, Ed, we will be able to add 10 to 20 years of life, quality life. So does that mean we now need to imagine we're all going to, you know, average lifespan is going to become 100? And what does that mean for this conversation and how we think about seniors?
Everyone has their personal experiences, and they're very emotionally laden personal experiences, because you're watching loved ones in circumstances often of deterioration. And I guess I've got to say that I find it, in my own experience, incredibly frustrating. I'm trying to deal with something that seems very simple to me, television. My mother wants to watch television, and she can't manage her television. In fact, it's that her television is bad. You know, her conception is not that she can't manage. So I'm just looking for, is there a simple 1970s television? You know, just something simple the way they used to be. And if you go online and you look for television for seniors and this and that, you get these complex 4K TVs, you know, that happen to have bigger letters on the remote, but there's, you know, nothing more simple. And you feel pretty helpless in this system, I've got to say. It's not a question, Georgia. It's just a comment. And I guess underneath there is that everybody feels, I think, a heavy stake in getting this right.
Well, and I hope so, because, you know, you said in your opening remarks that this, you know, this population is sort of overlooked. And really, I mean, we're all headed there, right? It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. I think we're better as a country than how we're responding right now. And this is the opportunity to set ambition. And seniors are great volunteers in communities. They donate to not-for-profits. They have contributed in different ways to the economy and continue to do so. There's real economic imperative, I think, to look at this. And, oh, by the way, they vote. We vote. And I know this is a bit cliche because we all want to use COVID as our moment to advance the wrongs in our society. But, you know, report after report, we do not need another report, by the way. I'll lose my mind if I see another report being commissioned on this. We need to really focus on that vision and the execution on it. And this is, I think, our generation's moment to make that change that Romano and Donner and even Tommy Douglas imagined when they set out what healthcare would look like in Canada.
Let's just finish on that, on how we do that. The Speech from the Throne last September, the federal government, you know, pledged to work with the provinces on long-term care. We have a federal budget coming up next week. I don't know if it will deal with long-term care. You know, you said, you talked about pan-Canadian standards in your report for senior care. And I just wonder if that's realistic with the agenda so crowded, if that's the way to go, or if we should be in a more competitive federalism type of model.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, Ed. I think it's going to be hard, if I'm honest about it, to get agreement around pan-Canadian standards. So is it possible at the FPT table to align on guidance? Is that a more acceptable way? What are the evidence-based sort of guidelines that as a country we would encourage provinces to strive for that consider not only the operational aspects and the medical aspects, but also the experience of the senior and their caregiver? And I'm really intrigued with what Australia is doing now. They have, through their Royal Commission on Aged Care, committed to a senior's rights-based approach to their reforms. And that could be our opportunity to flip this around. There is leadership, I believe, required from the federal government, and I know that's hard to do. I think the federal government really needs to help with, we talked about the standards, funding, and the workforce. I would call for a national health human resource workforce strategy, of which personal support workers are an important element, and to move on that. And then the last piece I'll say, Ed, and I know you need to wrap, is, you know, together, and the feds have a role to play in this, but so do all of us. Let's change the narrative about Canadians in this country, about Canadian seniors in this country.
Yeah, well, I think we all could find agreement on certainly on that final point and the sense of urgency around this and the sense of shame of what's happened over the last year and a little bit in this country and in, you know, other countries, but particularly in Canada, which has been worse than average on something that we certainly don't want to be worse than average. We don't even want to be average. We want to excel. So, Georgina, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. The difficult discussions are the most rewarding ones at the end. And when the answers aren't easy, well, that's, you know, that's why you're around. That's why everybody with us today is around. That's why we have governments. That's why we have what may be an innovative private sector, currently a subject of debate, but certainly one that hasn't been sufficiently innovative in this area. And, you know, what the Public Policy Forum is committed to as well. So I want to thank you all, as well as you, Georgina, for attending and for participating. Now, I'd like to highlight the excellent contribution of one of our PPF members. This week, we are PPF proud of our member, Justice Canada, and want to highlight the work it has been doing in making the laws more knowable and understandable. As part of Justice Canada's commitment to access to justice, it has helped create resources focused on the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, whose anniversary is in April this month. These resources include Charterpedia, info bytes for social media infographics, and downloadable versions of the Charter, which can help us learn more about the protected rights and freedoms enshrined in Canada's highest law. This week, we celebrate, as I say, the Charter's 39th anniversary, and some of us can remember watching it on TV as young tykes, I am sure. And the famous blowing wind and one of the minister's hair blowing way out of place. This was an historic moment with the Queen, with Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and the Charter has obviously been central to the lives of Canadians ever since. So we thank Justice Canada for the work it is doing to help people understand the Charter better and make it part of their lives. PPF is a membership-based organization, as you know, and if you're not a member, well, what are you waiting for? Visit the membership page of our website, ppforum.ca, to find out more. And with that, we are wrapped on this edition of Policy Speaking. If you like the episode, leave us a review, share it with a friend, and let us know on Twitter at ppforumca. I want to thank my colleagues at the Public Policy Forum who make this podcast happen. Until next time, I'm Edward Greenspun, and this has been Policy Speaking.